it may cause some surprise to learn that the operatic tenor, the present-day superstar of the operatic world, was in fact the latecomer into the operatic scene. Up until the beginning of the 19th century, the principal male operatic hero was the castrato, a breed that demand a place in operatic history on their own. This is not the place to discuss at length the wonders and attributes of these astonishing male soprano and contralto singers. But even here, their existence must be acknowledged, for they represented the age of bel canto, an age when the singer reigned supreme. What were they like? That has been a question asked down through the years, and we, who can never hear them, can only read and wonder. Henry Pleasance summed them up in his book, The Great Singers. They practiced in an age when one looked not so much to the composer or the librettist as the source of suspense and tension, as to the singer, and he, a soloist, had to make do without the harmonic vocabulary and the articulate orchestra of 19th century opera. He was on his own. He had to develop his own devices and techniques, and he employed them to a large extent improvisationally, whether in the theatre, at court, in church, or in the salon. The mere aria or cantata provided a melodic skeleton or a framework to be completed by the singer from his own repertoire of ornaments, embellishments, graces, roulades, trills, portamenti, arpeggios, rubato, octave skips, melodic deviations, alterations and variations, and so on. Little wonder then that the great castrati represent a constant source of wonder to those of us interested in the vocal art. The last of them was Giovanni Battista Valuti, 1781 to 1861, and one illustration will perhaps tell us what they were about. We meet him in 1813 at the rehearsal of Rossini's new opera Aureliano in Palmira in Milan. Stendhal tells us the story. Valuti was then in the full bloom of his youth and vigour, at the very height of his genius, and incidentally, one of the handsomest men of his century. And he made shameless abuse of his prodigious gifts. Rossini had never actually heard this outstanding singer on the stage. Nonetheless, he sat straight away and composed the main cavatina which was to belong to the role. At the first rehearsal with the orchestra, Valuti sang the aria straight through, and Rossini was dazzled with admiration. At the second rehearsal, Valuti began to embroider the melody, and Rossini, finding the result both exquisite in performance and in keeping with his own intention as composer, approved. But at the third rehearsal, the original pattern of the melody had almost entirely disappeared beneath a marvellous filigree work of embroidery and arabesque. At last it dawned the great day of the premiere. The cavatina itself, and in fact Valuti's whole performance, created a furore. But Rossini found himself confronted with insuperable difficulties in trying to identify what Valuti was supposed to be singing. His own music, in fact, had grown completely unrecognisable. For all that, however, Valuti's performance was a thing of unparalleled beauty and enjoyed popularity with the audience, which, after all, can never be blamed for applauding something which it so wholeheartedly enjoys. The young composer's vanity was deeply wounded. His opera was a failure, and all the applause had gone to Valuti, his soprano. Rossini was always quick to size up a situation, and instantly drew the inevitable conclusions. In future, he would write down his own ornamentation and insist that the singers use it and nothing else. The age of bel canto was over. Valuti was, in fact, surrounded by many excellent tenors throughout his career, and to live to see tenors assume that supreme station among males in the operatic hierarchy that they have enjoyed and abused to this day. And so to our first great superstar tenor, and he was to be the incomparable Giovanni Battista Rubini. Born in 1795, he was the first normal male to achieve international renown and a huge popular following corresponding to that hitherto reserved for prima donnas and castrati, and to command commensurate fees. One might assume that this new kind of tenor would be the forerunner of the dramatic or lirico spinto tenor that we know today. Rubini was nothing of the kind. He was rather an ungelded castrato. He had a pock-marked face, an awkward figure, and showed neither taste nor care in dress. He was an indifferent actor, or no actor at all. In the opera, he walked through his parts, didn't bother much with recitatives, paid some attention to his duties in concerted numbers, and awaited his moment, possibly just one aria in one entire opera, and then he sang. He was simply all singer. Chorley noted happily in his book 30 Years Musical Recollections that there never was an artist who seemed so thoroughly and intensely to enjoy his own singing. A persuasion, he added cogently, which cannot fail to communicate itself to audiences. As a singer, and nothing but a singer, he is the only man of his class who deserves to be named in these pages. No one, in my experience, so merely and exclusively a singer as he was, so entirely enchanted our public, so long as a shred of voice was left in him, no one is more affectionately remembered. In 1843, he toured with Liszt, and it was probably Rubini, more than anyone, who provided the famous Liszt remark that he had learned to phrase on the piano from listening to great singers. Later, in the same year, Rubini went to St. Petersburg, where he was made director of singing in the realm of Tsar Nicholas I, and a colonel of the imperial music. He returned to Italy about 1845 and retired to his birthplace, Romano di Lombardia, near Bergamo, to live out his life with one of the greatest fortunes ever amassed on the stage. There he built a splendid palazzo, preserved to this day as a Rubini Museum, and there, on March 24, 1854, he died. And with his last breath, the age of the singer supreme, the true age of bel canto, in fact, expired with him, for now the age of grand opera was about to dawn, and a new kind of tenor would be required to meet its demands. The first of the new breed was Domenico Donizelli, whose dark baritonal tenor voice was the forerunner of all those baritone cum tenors such as Doreschi, Zenatello, Zanelli and Melchior. But the most important tenor of this period was the first of the great French tenors, Adolphe Nourrit, born in 1802. This wonderful singing actor was the father of all those great dramatic singing actors from Tamberlik, Campanini, Doreschi, Slezak, Caruso, Martinelli to Domingo of the present day. He was probably the most creative tenor of all time. The roles written specifically for him include the lead in Rossini's Moses in Egypt, The Siege of Corinth, Comte, Ori and William Tell, Auber's Gustave III and La Muette de Portique, Halévy's La Juive and Meyerbeer's Robert the Devil and the Huguenots. Indeed, until Verdi and Wagner came along, it could be said that Nourrit, virtually single-handed, had made a repertoire for the new dramatic tenor. His reign at the Paris Opera lasted from 1826 to 1837, when his great rival and countryman Dupré arrived to sing one of his Nourrit's roles, Arnold in William Tell. This was too much for Nourrit, who withdrew from the opera and spent the remaining 2 years of his life touring the French provinces and Italy, while the public and the critics argued the merits of the situation and of the two tenors. Nourrit was disconsolate, feeling that the less sophisticated art of the acting singer had triumphed over his own more refined accomplishments as a singing actor. He never felt quite at home away from Paris, although he was successful enough even in Italy. He developed symptoms of mental illness, and early in the morning of the 8th of March 1939, he jumped to his death from the window of a third-floor apartment in Naples. When his body was passing through Marseille on its way back to Paris, there was a funeral service at the Church of Notre-Dame-du-Mont on April the 24th, 1839. The organist was one of Nury's many friends, Frédéric Chopin. Unusually, the next great tenor was another Frenchman, a great rival and countryman, Gilbert-Louis Dupré, part of whose operatic fame was that he was the very first tenor to sing the high C from the chest. He had been singing in Italy for 10 years, creating Egardo in Lucia di Lammermoor in Naples in 1835, when he made his sensational debut at the Paris Opera as Arnold in William Tell in 1837. The stentorian high C and his fine voix sombre probably shortened the life of his voice and deprived him of the great variety of nuance and vocal colour that so distinguished Nourrit's singing of the same dramatic repertoire. He seemed to have the urge, not uncommon among small tenors, to compensate for his diminutive size by producing stentorian tones. "What," screamed a ballet girl when he appeared for the dress rehearsal of his first William Tell in Paris, "that toad? Impossible!" Rossini did not admire his high C, and when he first heard it in his own home, expressed his opinion by looking to see if any of his precious Venetian glass had been shattered. In any event, by 1849, he had sung himself out, and although only 43, he retired. He lived to be 89, remaining active as a successful teacher and unsuccessful composer. Although the line of the great Italian dramatic tenors is most conveniently dated from Donizetti, the first to display fully the vocal characteristics now commonly associated with Italian dramatic tenors was Enrico Tamberlik, 1820 to 1889. Between Donizelli and Tamberlik had come the Frenchmen Nourrit and Dupré, with a new repertoire provided for them by Rossini, Halévy, Auber, Berlioz, and of course Meyerbeer. Tamberlik sang his French repertoire as well as Donizelli's great roles of Otello and Pollione, but he added to it a new kind of Italian role provided by Verdi. Among his Verdi roles were Manrico in Il Trovatore and the Duke in Rigoletto, the title role in Ernani and the role of Don Alvaro in La Forza del Destino, which he created in St. Petersburg in 1862. He also sang the title role in Gounod's Faust and the role of Ugo in the Faust of Louis Spohr. This repertoire, which also included Don Ottavio in Don Giovanni, suggests both a considerable versatility and a kind of voice midway between the lyric tenor and a heavy tenore robusto that has been the glory of the greatest tenors, notably De Reschke, De Lucia, Caruso, Gigli, Lore Volpi, Fléter and Björling. These have all been singers who could bring virility as well as sweetness to lyric roles, and leaven the vehemence of the most dramatic parts with lyrical singing. Tamberlik's repertoire makes it evident that he was such a singer. His high C, and even a full-voiced C-sharp, interpolated in Rossini's Otello, were doubtless a decisive contribution to the high-note scourge. P.G. Hirst, in his The Age of Jean de Reschke, recalls the revival of Otello for Tamberlik in the London season of 1877, and how the evening's triumph was due to its famous C-sharp, ringing out with such extraordinary power and freshness that a repetition of the passage was demanded and granted. Tamberlik was then 57, suggesting that such ventures cost him less of his life's blood and vocal resources than they had cost Dupré. His voice showed signs of decay elsewhere, but at that age it could hardly be counted against a high note alone. He belonged apparently to that lucky tribe among whom the high notes are the last to go: Lazzaro, Martinelli, Zenatello, Lore Volpe are other typical examples. It was Tamberlik II who added the high C to Di Quella Pira in Il Trovatore, with Verdi's permission, although he warned Tamberlik and all future tenors that they had better be good. He was not without faults. He had a persistent vibrato and a tendency to sing out of time occasionally. It was Rossini who had correctly foreseen that Dupré's high C from the chest would surely prompt someone to try the high C sharp. Tamberlik it was who first succeeded, and again not to Rossini's liking. When visiting Rossini's home, he was requested to leave his C sharp in the vestibule, along with his hat and cloak. Although born in Rome, he seems to have sung little in Italy. He made his debut in Naples, but sang in Lisbon, Madrid and Barcelona before arriving in London in 1850, the only tenor of his time capable of surviving against Mario. Thereafter, he was regularly in London for the season. At other times, he was in St. Petersburg or Madrid, or touring in North or South America. He had an affinity for Spain and settled in Madrid at the close of his career, building a new life as an arms manufacturer. However celebrated Nourrit, Dupré and Tamberlik may have been, they were not in fact the true successor to Rubini, in international acclaim and esteem. That mantle fell upon the shoulders of Giovanni Matteo Mario Cavaliere di Candia, known then and forever simply as Mario. For 30 years, he was the world's ranking tenor. He created no roles of any historical account. In the Meyerbeer operas, which were among his best, he probably surpassed Nourrit and Dupré in beauty of voice and elegance of person, but he lacked their dramatic force and fervour. He sang Rubini's roles with less eccentricity than Rubini, but without his art and invention. As Shorley observed, Rubini, with whom the modern Italian tenor repertoire began, in roles written for him by Donizetti and Bellini, had been such an extraordinary virtuoso that composers were tempted to write for him what no one but Rubini could sing. As an aristocrat, he entered music as an amateur, and he was simply so good that the profession took hold of him. He started straight at the top, his debut taking place in 1838 in Meyerbeer's Robert the Devil at the Paris Opera, then the world's greatest opera house. At 28, he was a late beginner by the standards of that time or any other time. At the top he stayed, and although not a truly creative singer, he established certain criteria in matters of appearance, dress and deportment that were accepted as models by later tenors intelligent enough to acknowledge the validity of any criteria other than vocal. He was probably the prototype of the romantic tenor, more often imagined and seen. He married the celebrated soprano Giulia Grisi, and when they were joined by the great bass and bass baritone singers Luigi Lablache and Antonio Tamburini, they formed an elitist group known as the Great Quartet. Their reign endured for roughly 25 years, from 1835 to 1860, and the symbol of their identity and supremacy was Don Pasquale, written for them by Donizetti in 1843. They came to be known affectionately as the Old Guard and concentrated on the Rossini, Bellini, Donizetti repertoire in which they were unequalled in their day. Mario outlived Grisi by 14 years, and with his voice in decline, he outlived his prosperity too. A fortune had been dissipated, and his circumstances towards the end were so pitiable that in London a concert was given for his benefit. He died in Rome on December 11, 1883. The retirement of Mario ushered in what has become known as the last golden age of opera. It may well have been the most golden of all. It certainly was the most diversified. Henry Pleasance again. The Rossini, Donizetti, Bellini repertoire was still sung, and it was sung well. although some of the old standbys stood no more. Meyerbeer's output had been augmented by the Prophet and L'Africaine. The tradition of florid song had been nourished not by Italian composers, curiously, but by the French. In the operas of Gounod, Thomas, Derlieb, and Massenet. Bizet, with Carmen, had anticipated the verismo operas of the later Italians by a generation. Verdi's already substantial contribution had been crowned by Aida, Otello, and Falstaff. Wagner's production was complete, and even his last works were making their way into the repertoire around the world, and Richard Strauss was in the offing. The greatest tenor of this last golden age was Polish, Jean Dereski. Mario's heir was every bit as handsome as Mario had been, and more imposing of voice and presence. He sang a wider repertoire, but of course, there was a wider repertoire available to sing. Radames, Don José, Vasco da Gama, Lohengrin, Walter, Tristan, and the Siegfrieds, in addition to most of the roles that Mario had sung. Dereski was, in addition to all else, very much a creature of his time, elegant in manner and song, a romantic figure, the ideal Romeo and Faust, and he was the first tenor of the French and Italian repertoire to sing the mature Wagner and in German. Some eminent critics thought that this extensive repertoire cost him 10 years of vocal life. They could be right, for within 6 years of his first Tristan in 1895, at the age of 51, Jean Dereski was finished. And he could be guilty of a kind of petulant laziness. He confessed to Martinelli, for example, that in his 19 performances of Radames in Aida at the Metropolitan, he had sung the main tenor aria, Celeste Aida, only 4 times, because it was too difficult an aria to sing before I was properly warmed up. However, there seems no doubt that, as an all-round finished artist with a repertoire that no tenor has equalled before or since, he was unapproachable. He sang far too often for vocal longevity. Take the months of November to February 1896 as example. He sang 25 times, his roles including Romeo, Lohengrin, Tristan, Radames, Faust, Raoul in Les Huguenots, De Grau, Don José, Walter in The Master Singers. This averages a performance every 3.5 days. In the following season, he went even beyond that, singing 36 times in 97 days, or a fraction over a performance every 2.5 days, including the lead in Siegfried, Le Cid, L'Africaine, and Werther. A final tribute, perhaps, from one of his fellow artists at the Metropolitan, David Bistam. Taking him all in all, he was the finest artist of his generation, a tower of strength to her company, and a vocal and physical adornment to the stage he elevated by his presence. Unfortunately for us, Dereski retired just before the advent of the recording process, although Colonel Mapleson, a former Metropolitan manager and an enthusiastic supporter of the new invention, did try to capture a few scraps from actual performances on cylinders situated high above the stage on the catwalk. I have heard all of these cylinders at one time or another, and they're all mostly dreadful, the Dereski's worst of all, so it is impossible to gain from them even an inkling of the style and production of the voice. It is certain that Dereski made test records for the Phonotypia Company of arias from Le Cid and Romeo, and possibly also for the Gramophone Company. He disliked these tests and was extremely disappointed with the results, refusing to pass any for publication. Despite numerous rumours throughout the years, there is supposed to be a test copy in a Paris bank vault, no one has come up with either so far. Of course, produced many other famous tenors. Italo Campanini, the earliest, could be argued to have been the link between Mario and Dereski. Julian Gary, a great Spanish tenor, idolized in his own country and in South America. Roberto Stagno, a fine singer and actor, and married to an equally famous soprano, Gemma Bellincione, the two forming a Verismo partnership famous in the annals of opera in Italy. Angelo Massini, Caruso's idol, a wonderful singer, famous throughout Italy and Spain, and idolized in Russia. He settled in St. Petersburg, and although approached to make records there, refused all offers, considering the new invention merely a toy. What a loss!